Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The flight schedule may be back to normal at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, but how we think about safety and security inside airports has changed. Airports are places of transit and commerce. They help move people and cargo, and therefore money, around. A new passenger route or cargo carrier can mean a new investment and jobs. That's why millions of dollars are spent on building and rebuilding airports, from renovating aging terminals to adding a new runway. They're vital to a dynamic economy, allowing locals to export knowledge and for a region to import new ideas. Millions of tourists' first experience here is stepping off a plane and into one of our airports. They are way stations on the path to someplace else. Since Friday, the airport, an American airport, a South Florida airport, has changed. The carnage unleashed by a gunman Friday afternoon near the baggage claim area inside Terminal 2 at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport is incomprehensible, except for the fact that it happened. It happened here. In the middle of a sunny Friday, as hundreds of travelers were moving toward what was supposed to come next for them, a 26-year-old Army private combat veteran is accused of opening fire. In moments, five were shot and would die. Thousands of travelers would be caught up in the chaos as Esteban Santiago surrendered to police. While investigators continue piecing together the moments, days, and months of Santiago's life leading up to the mass shooting, it has led to an understandable discussion now about airport security and a return to the debate over gun ownership. Now, we'll talk with the head of the busiest airport in Florida and a magnet for economic activity about security later on in this program. But first, airport safety and firearm access, with two U.S. congresswomen whose districts include the big airports here in South Florida. Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton's district includes MIA. Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz represents the district that includes the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, the scene of Friday's attack. Representative, thanks for joining us again on the Sunshine Economy. Do you consider the attack at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport inside your district, was that international terrorism?
Well, it's premature to declare it international terrorism, but it is certainly an act of domestic terrorism and doesn't make it any more or less tragic. The FBI is in the process of investigating the motives of the suspect, and there will be time to make a determination about that.
Does there need to be a federal response regarding airport security after the attack?
Well, there's no question that we need to take a hard look at the unsecured public areas of our transportation hubs, like baggage claim areas and lobbies of train stations and the public areas of ports. Specifically, I'm going to go back to Washington today and start a review process of communicating with our TSA and other Homeland Security leadership to deal with that question. But there are, much deeper concerns in addition to that, including whether we should allow people to travel with firearms and checked bags any longer. And if you do, the question of where you have them reunited with that firearm so that they can't do harm to the public.
Mm-hmm. And so is that the focus of your initial request for a review, is this this regulation that allows firearms to be checked baggage?
I'm going to spend a day or so exploring the variety of questions, whether people should be allowed to carry firearms in checked baggage, the question of if you are, then perhaps we restrict your ability to travel with ammunition, that you could review how people are reunited with their firearms. We have to review the security of public areas like baggage claim areas. And in addition to that, we most definitely, because this is obviously a mentally ill individual, to make matters worse, who cried out for help, who was involuntarily committed and had his firearm returned to him a month later, there are some serious gaps in the mental health system, particularly the involuntary commitment system, that need to be reviewed.
And I want to ask you about some of those gun access and ownership issues that this tragedy brings to light yet again here in the state of Florida. But first, back to airport security. After the 2009 underwear bomber in Detroit, Full body scanners were introduced into airports, a $500 million investment. There were 5,000 TSA agents that were hired. Do you anticipate that level of response after this tragedy at Fort Lauderdale?
I mean, as I said with your other question, we're putting the cart before the horse here. It is impossible to anticipate what a review would reveal as far as our needs. But we have, over time, responded and balanced our security needs in our nation with the travels, with the traveling public's ability to freely travel. And in that review, that's something that we need to consider. But I serve on the Appropriations Committee, and most definitely I'm going to look into the kinds of investments we need to make sure that the public is safer when they travel through a transportation hub in our country.
It's not just exclusive to airports, then?
Well, my focus initially is certainly going to be airports. But this is a gaping hole that the 9/11 Commission recognized existed, and they had recommendations related to securing unsecured areas, public areas, and that was never done.
Let's talk about the issue of mental health and gun access. The suspected gunman here, as you mentioned, Esteban Santiago, spoke with the FBI a couple of months ago in Alaska, telling agents that he heard voices talking about ISIS. Should he have been allowed to fly with a firearm as checked baggage, or should he have appeared automatically on some kind of no-fly list given that encounter?
Well, there's no question that we have to tighten the system in which we take people's weapons away when they have been adjudicated mentally ill. And now, in Florida, we have the Baker Act, and that's one set of rules. And what I want to take a look at is, do we have 50 different sets of rules for how someone is involuntarily committed? I don't know what Alaska's rules were for the criteria or what the criteria were for him being able to have his weapon returned to him. But certainly if he was involuntarily committed, someone's involuntarily committed, meaning they are committed to a mental institution, not of their own volition, then that should definitely trigger, in my mind, and I want to know why it wouldn't, someone being on a no-fly list, someone being unable to carry a weapon. And if there are 50 different rules that have criteria for that decision, then that really needs to be reviewed at the federal level and make them more uniform.
Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel on Saturday, you appeared alongside him at Fort Lauderdale Hollywood yes. International Airport. He spoke about gun ownership rules. I want to play a bit of his comments and have you respond to it. Here's Sheriff Israel on Saturday.
A conversation that needs to happen, certainly, is we need to talk about as a country going forward when people are on no-fly lists and, you know, people suffering from mental illness, you know, they're not problem people. We all know they're people with very real problems, but if they are suffering from a mental illness or they're on a no-fly zone, on a no-fly list, or they're a convicted felon, they flat out shouldn't be allowed to own handguns or rifles.
Now, of course, the suspect here, Esteban Santiago, was not convicted, didn't have any particular reason not to be able to have access to a legally purchased gun. Should someone, Congresswoman, appears on a no-fly list, should they be able to own a gun?
No, there's no way that you should be able to get on an airplane. There's no way that if you cannot get on an airplane, if you are prohibited from flying in this country, then there's no way we should have let you have a weapon because if you're too dangerous to fly, you're too dangerous to carry.
And this was an the legislative issue to ban that failed after the Pulse nightclub shooting.
It did. And that is outrageous that there are Republicans in this Congress that refuse to support taking guns away from people who we prohibit from traveling on our airplanes. I mean, if you are too dangerous to fly, then you are too dangerous to carry a gun. No fly, no buy should be the law of the land. And while that would not have been applicable here, we do need to really take a look at whether or not we have an efficient and uniform system in place. I know we don't, and we have a lot of gaps to close. When someone has been adjudicated mentally ill in this country, you are prohibited from carrying a firearm. And there are obviously many, many gaps like this one that I want to review so that we can see why this individual was not prohibited from carrying a firearm when he had been involuntarily committed.
Representative, let me ask you about some state efforts here, playing upon your previous experience as a state legislator. Republican Senator in Sarasota, Greg Stube, wants to allow concealed weapons in unsecured areas of airports. His legislation would also allow concealed carry on college campuses and government meetings. He spoke about his intention to Suncoast News Network over the weekend.
Every one of these shootings in recent time have all occurred in gun-free zones. They don't occur in a Walmart or a Publix where people are carrying. They occur in gun-free zones like bars, in college campuses, and at airports.
What are your thoughts about this concealed carry expansion in Florida?
It's ludicrous to suggest that the solution to a mass shooting in a public area is to add more firearms to that situation. I mean, we have people who are traveling at an airport and I talk to law enforcement about this all the time when I go back and forth to Fort Lauderdale, through Fort Lauderdale Airport, who are in a higher stress level situation. You know, traveling is a stressful situation for many people. Add a weapon to someone who is already experiencing stress is going to make the problem worse. And then the important point to note about this particular situation is that the suspect was taken down by the Broward Sheriff's Office in 76 seconds, and they are to be commended. They did a remarkable job. The passengers I spoke to when I was at the airport all day on Saturday were, you know, very praiseworthy of the BSO. But you had people for far longer than 76 seconds fleeing all over the airport because there was a significant amount of uncertainty. If you have people who are allowed to have weapons introduced into an uncertain, stressful situation, more carnage would have resulted. If you recall, there was uncertainty over whether there was another shooter in a different terminal long after the shooter was taken down. And if you had people who had weapons, passengers who were allowed to have weapons on their person, just start opening fire because of what they thought was going on, it would have been worse and there would have been more deaths and injuries.
Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Still to come, a view from the other side of the political aisle from the Republican Congresswoman who represents Miami International Airport.
It's a horrific a tragedy for all of South Florida because whether you're in Miami International Airport or Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood Airport, it's all known as South Florida, the tourists, and they've come to rely on our airport facilities as being safe places where you can travel without a problem.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Airport Attack. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. We're talking about the attack at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport on Friday. The suspect, Esteban Santiago, is in federal custody, charged with several crimes, including violence at an airport and murder. The charges could make him eligible for the death penalty. Four of the five victim identities have been released. The four were all visitors to South Florida, underscoring just how important our airports are for our number one industry, tourism. Now, coming up, we will talk with the top boss at Miami International Airport about security. But first, continuing our discussion about safety and firearm access with top national lawmakers. Next, we speak with Republican Ileana Ross-Leighton. Her district includes MIA. Representative, thanks for joining us here on the Sunshine Economy. Do you consider the attack on Friday a case of international terrorism yet?
Well, all the reports, Tom, seem to indicate that the shooter had no known ties to terrorism, or to any terror group, had not become radicalized. All the evidence so far leads us to conclude that he had mental health issues, which were not properly addressed, even when he turned himself into the FBI office in Anchorage and said that he's been having thoughts that were guided by an intelligence agency and telling him to join Islamic terrorism groups. So the authorities had come to realize that this gentleman had, serious mental health issues. But so far, all the sources have told us that there is no tie to terrorism. It's a horrific a tragedy for all of South Florida because whether you're in Miami International Airport or Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood Airport, it's all known as South Florida,
yeah,
for tourists, and they've come to rely on our airport facilities as being safe places where you can travel without a problem. We have a lot of security. I'm not as familiar with Fort Lauderdale as I am with Miami International Airport, where we go there every week as we go to Washington, D.C.,
sure,
and I feel very confident that the security situation there is under control.
You and your congressional colleagues head back today to reconvene for a new Congress that officially happened last week, but you're back in session this week. Does there need to be a federal response regarding airport security after this tragedy?
Well, as human beings, once we see a problem, a tragedy unfold, we are common sense individuals, and we always want to say, well, if we just pass this law, then this problem will go away. But while looking at what has unfolded with the shooter, Esteban Santiago, it seems like everything at the airport was being done in the correct way. He had checked his firearm and what was the only piece of checked baggage, in fact, that he had, and then went to the bathroom, loaded it up, and started shooting. When he ran out of ammunition, he let himself be taken by the sheriff's deputies. So we have a tendency to think this is a problem, so we need to pass a law, that problem will go away. I don't think that in this particular situation anything could have been done with a person who has mental health issues, who had gone to a facility to say, hey, something is wrong with me, and no real follow-up was done. So if there's anything that needs to be done, perhaps it's not so much in the airport security issues as with mental health issues once he turns himself in. Why was there no follow-up from different authorities?
Representative, before we turn our attention to that issue, let me focus just a little bit more on airport security. Your colleague, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who we spoke to earlier in the program on Saturday, spoke about this ability to fly with a firearm as checked baggage. I want you just to respond to one thing that Representative Wasserman Schultz said on Saturday. Here's what she said.
There's no question that we need to review not only the question of whether people should be able to travel but with their firearms, even if they're in checked baggage, but I think we need to take a hard look at the security around baggage claim areas and not just leave it at that.
She went on to note other unsecured areas of public travel like train stations and ports. Do you agree that needs to be reviewed, these unsecured landside areas of airports and other public travel areas?
We could review all of our lives and say, boy, when I go to this rental car place, there's no security there. So let's make it very secure to be able to rent a car. And let's make it super secure to be able to get your checked bag. In fact, in our daily lives, when you read, write out what you've done during that day and how you got to location A or B or C, you'll see that there is very little security around our lives. And I don't know that we want to live in a society where everywhere you go, you have these extreme security measures. It is true that when you go to the airport, I've been to many, I don't know who has any of the facilities that would check you as you go into getting your checked baggage. That is not the secure area. Mm-hmm. The secure area is for getting onto your flight.
Mm-hmm.
So could we make it so that every aspect of our life has so much security that no possible harm could be done to us? I suppose we could have that kind of a life, but it doesn't really define us as an American society with freedom and not so many restrictions. Sure, we need to feel safe, but people have to know and use common sense to know that there are certain areas in your life where you're not going to have that security.
And is one of those continued to be the baggage claim area of an airport?
Well, maybe probably you can make it so that people would have to have security when you go into that area, meaning the airport itself, you would not have any unsecured areas. But think of the cost that that would entail. Yeah. People would have to be willing to pay so much more extra to buy your ticket to fly from point A to point B, or you could make a user fee that if you're going to the airport, then you would pay extra to have that screening. There, everything has a cost and a dollar value. What cost and dollar value can you put to a human life? Of course, if you analyze it that way, then every part of our life would have security, and because every life is precious. But we have to understand that the world is an unsafe place, and not everything can be, can you prevent something from happening? The most egregious cases were in 9/11 when they were allowed to board a plane, and we've put an end to that kind of insecure flying. Mm-hmm. But to get your bags in a baggage claim, I guess you could make everything very difficult, but I don't know that as Americans we want to feel that way.
Let me move on
everything.
Let me move on in our short time here, Representative, sure. to gun ownership and gun access. You spoke about some of the mental health issues that have been brought up from the alleged shooter here, Esteban Santiago. He went to talk to FBI officials in Alaska a couple of months ago, telling agents that he heard voices talking to him about ISIS. The case was turned over to local police. Should that encounter have been enough for him to appear on a no-fly list of some kind?
Well, I would like to not know more information about what went on in that interview in Anchorage FBI office, because if someone is saying to you that he's hearing voices from Islamic groups telling him he needs to watch recruitment videos and training videos, that's someone who should not be on a list to freely travel. But so far, we've heard reports about it. Before we make laws and legislate about what we should do, we've got to make sure that we have all of the information.
Okay.
From what I've read so far, yes, that should have sent off alarm signals and telling you this is a person who should be on the no-fly list, and perhaps this tragedy could have been avoided. As we all know, hindsight is 20/20. But looking back on it, there was a red flag. Bells would have gone off. There's no way that that person should have been allowed to travel. What does it take to be on the no-fly list? I think someone who says they're hearing voices from Islamic terrorism groups, that's a pretty good signal.
Sunday on Local 10s this week in South Florida, the sheriff of Broward County, Scott Israel, agreed that the shootings were a game changer in the gun debate. I want you to listen to just a quick something he said on the television program and respond to it. Here's Sheriff Israel on Sunday.
This isn't about Amendment 2. Our state representatives, our federal representatives, our senators, we need to get together and we need to say enough is enough. We need to stop the violence, and we need to limit the ability of people who are suffering from mental illness, who are convicted felons, who are put on no-fly lists. You shouldn't have firearms. You shouldn't have rifles.
Now, of course, none of that necessarily applied to Esteban Santiago prior to Friday afternoon at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. Do you anticipate that this tragedy is going to spark another vigorous actual floor debate, perhaps even a vote on gun legislation in the Congress?
Well, I think it should spur us into saying, what can we do when someone is actually telling you that he has mental health issues and yet is given back his firearm and allowed to fly? I don't know that this will spur a debate on gun legislation. I don't think that that's the key issue. I think the real problem is this is a person with serious mental health issues who's telling you that he's got voices in his head, and still nothing happened. So it's horrific that it's once again a tragedy in our state. But I think people should become more familiar with the security in our airports. Miami International Airport is a real revenue enhancer. It's a place where tourists come to catch their cruise ships. And look at how many of these victims were off to go on their cruise ships. It's a major tourism driver, and people should know more about the security at the places where they go. And that's the kind of more information that people should be involved with. I don't know that this will spur a gun control debate or a vote in Congress, because I don't see it as that's the key element in this tragic situation. It's the mental health issues of this man who is obviously in trouble and seeking help and not finding it, and this is what he does. And it is a real problem for a tourism-driven economy, as is South Florida.
U.S. Representative Ileana Ross-Leighton. Her district includes Miami International Airport. So, still to come, how the boss at a huge economic engine, MIA, balances security and efficiency in commerce.
When somebody asks me, are you happy with the security at MIA, my immediate response is always no. Because the day you're happy with what you have, you become complacent.
This is the Sunshine Economy Airport Attack. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Between Christmas and New Year's Day, 53 guns were found by Transportation Security Administration agents at American airports, according to the TSA's blog. 42 of them were loaded, 15 had a bullet in the chamber. One of the loaded weapons was discovered at MIA. A week later, one was found at Palm Beach International Airport, and four at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, including one gun found on Christmas Day. The suspected gunman in the Fort Lauderdale attack on Friday is not charged with the crime for transporting his weapon on a flight, nor transporting his ammunition. Law enforcement thinks Esteban Santiago did that legally. It's alleged he put the ammunition in his gun after picking them up at a baggage claim area before opening fire, killing five people. Emilio Gonzalez is the director and chief executive officer of the Miami-Dade Aviation Department, where he heads up Miami International Airport. Director Gonzalez, thank you for joining us here on WLRN. Any noticeable changes for passengers at Miami International in response to the Fort Lauderdale attack?
Not especially. I mean, we have a very robust law enforcement presence since that event. I think the passengers appreciate it. A couple of them have come up and talked to the officers and thanked them for their service. So I think people understand this is an aberration. Folks will continue to travel. They'll be a lot more cautious. But I haven't seen any change at all in our passengers.
Is it fair to say there's at least a more visible presence of law enforcement at MIA?
Well, yes, that's on purpose, by the way.
Yeah, and visible with long guns, for instance?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's also on purpose.
And what are those types of weapons that the law enforcement officers are visibly showing passengers now?
Most of them are AR-15s. You see law enforcement officers dressed very tactical. Some of them have helmets on. The idea, you know, there's a security effect in making people feel safe and secure, and there's also a deterrence effect.
Yeah. And how long do you anticipate that kind of visible presence to continue?
We are in the process now of ramping that down a little bit. You're always going to see them there. Sometimes you see more or less of them, but there's always a presence. We take security very seriously, and there's security that you see and there's security that you don't see. And when it comes to a deterrent effect, we want to make sure that we have as many people out there as, in as many visible locations at the airport.
Who is responsible for security at MIA?
Many people are. The Miami-Dade County, we have a very robust law enforcement presence there from Miami-Dade Police Department. We also have Transportation Security Administration folks. Mm-hmm. We have Customs and Border Protection folks. We have other DHS law enforcement professionals there. So it really is a group effort, and we coordinate and train together regularly.
You've got 3.5 million passengers that go through MIA per month. It is the busiest local port for commerce, even busier than Port Miami or Port Everglades. What are some of the best practices that you continue to look at and review, even in light of the Fort Lauderdale tragedy?
No, we don't announce those. We're always looking for a better way to do our jobs. We don't announce our security protocols. I'm in contact with the airport director at Fort Lauderdale. He's a good friend. I'll be visiting him as soon as possible so that we can go over pretty much what happened. You know, these events tend to be one-offs in the sense that this will happen. It hadn't happened before. You know, even 9/11 didn't happen before. So as a result, you end up looking at these events you analyze them, you look at what happened, you look at what could have been better, you look at where there may be some perceived gaps in security, and then you address those one by one.
Could, for instance, the baggage claim area, which is this unsecured landside area where this tragedy occurred at Fort Lauderdale, could that be better secured? Could you have similar security procedures for that area as you do for the airport side of the facility?
Well, remember, up until very recently, the concentration was on protecting aircraft and the traveling public on the air side. Can we do more? Absolutely. Will we do more? Yes. But remember that the airport is a public facility. So if you wanted to show up and read a book in a lobby or the terminal every day, you probably could. So what we're looking at now is, you know, what's in people's minds? How do we get more folks on the ground? How do we get more reaction time? How do we use better technology? I mean, there's always a better way to do business. The challenge is trying to be one step ahead of a perpetrator.
One of the other challenges you have, certainly at Miami International, is the economic prominence of the airport. It is a huge economic engine in South Florida. So would greater airport security threaten any of that?
I don't think so. I'll tell you what, and based on what you just said, it's probably the biggest economic engine in the state, which means
it's the largest airport in the state by passenger volume, so you're probably right.
Right. So shutting down an airport, even for a day or two, has huge economic consequences. And we're very cognizant of that, and we're constantly looking for ways to increase and improve our security. When somebody asks me, are you happy with the security at MIA? My immediate response is always no, because the day you're happy with what you have, you become complacent and anything can happen. So security is one of these things that we're constantly looking at. We're looking for better ways. We're looking for more efficient ways. And we do so in a way that will not disrupt the traveling public or, to your point, the commerce and that goes through there every day.
Director Gonzalez, one of the areas that state lawmakers will be considering in regards to public safety is an expansion of concealed carry. Senator Greg Stube from Sarasota is a Republican. He's sponsoring a concealed weapons bill that would allow the concealed carry of firearms at unsecured areas of airports, on college campuses, and at government meetings. It was introduced about a week and a half ago. And I want you to respond to something that he told the Suncoast News Network about his thoughts around his legislation.
Well, had the bill been law today, any licensed concealed permit holder who was in that baggage claim area would have been permitted to carry and defend themselves if they were in that circumstance.
So, Director Gonzalez, as one who's responsible ultimately for the safety and security of Miami International Airport, the busiest airport in Florida, what are your thoughts about this expansion potential of concealed carry?
Well, listen, I have a concealed carry, and I don't think I could support that. We need to keep as many weapons out of the airport as possible. That's not to say that there isn't a good rationale for concealed carry in other areas, but in an airport environment, the fact that you could carry a weapon anywhere around there, an incident could happen. It could be maybe something very benign. Law enforcement won't know, but they will know that there's a bunch of people carrying guns, and I think that would just exacerbate the situation. So right now, based on what I know, I don't think I could support that, but you're hearing that from a guy that's a big believer in concealed carry.
And a guy who's a military veteran, the CEO of Miami International Airport, Emilio Gonzalez. Now, the suspected Fort Lauderdale Airport gunman was a combat veteran himself who had scrapes with the law before allegedly opening fire on Friday. So still to come, we talk with a retired Army colonel about combat experience, bringing that home, working within a court system set up especially for veterans, and the employment environment found by veterans when they come back. It's all still ahead. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy Airport Attack. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Esteban Santiago stands accused of killing five Americans. Just a few years ago, his job was to protect America. He served in the war in Iraq for 10 months. He returned, serving in the Army Reserve, before joining the Alaska National Guard, where he was given a general discharge 4 months ago. While in Alaska, he worked as a security guard, according to his brother. He also began to get in trouble with the law. America's decade-plus military action in Iraq and Afghanistan has produced more than 2 million veterans. DJ Reyes retired from the U.S. Army as a colonel. He served as a top intelligence officer and in Special Operations Command during many combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, he's the coordinator of a special veterans treatment court in the Tampa area, and he joins us from our sister station in Tampa, WUSF. Colonel Reyes, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Sunshine Economy.
Thank you very much for having me on this show.
The suspect in the Fort Lauderdale airport attack served as a combat engineer for 10 months in Iraq. What kind of work would he have had included in his duties as a combat engineer?
Well, as a U.S. Army combat engineer, also known as 12 Bravo, which is the job designation, he would do such tasks as build fortified defensive positions, build bridges over water obstacles, detect and clear mines along routes as they're driving on convoys, and operate various types of heavy equipment.
Presumably, he would be in harm's way in those situations, wouldn't he?
Absolutely, because he was in Iraq at that time.
He reportedly, Esteban Santiago, the suspect here, was received the Iraq Campaign Medal with a campaign star. What is that honor given for?
And so the Iraq Campaign Medal is awarded or was awarded to service members who were deployed for duty within the borders of Iraq or within its territorial waters. There was also a general rule for time spent in order to qualify for this medal. Normally it was 30 consecutive days or 60 non-consecutive days. And so during the time he was there, from at least from what the news reports, from April 2010 to February 2011, he was there for 10 months, which qualifies for the medal. Additionally, service members receive campaign stars for each campaign that they participated in. And for Operation Iraqi Freedom, there were 7 phases. So he was there during that period between phase 6 and phase 7. Mm-hmm. I believe the news reported he had a campaign star, so they gave him credit for one campaign.
2011 to 2012, a 10-month deployment is what his military record shows, according to reports. He returned to the United States, was involved with the Reserve, and then got involved with the Alaska National Guard. What kind of mental health evaluation would or is conducted on somebody returning from Iraq that had served in this capacity?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and if I may say this. First, I wasn't in the suspect's unit, but I will tell you that pretty much the Army policies and standard operating procedures apply for units that are preparing to deploy as well as those that return in his case. So normally, we go through, Army units go through what's known as the POR process. That's Preparation for Overseas Readiness. Mm-hmm. At that point, everything is covered for your needs, whether it's medical shots, your legal considerations such as wills and powers of attorney, and then administratively taking care of your personal belongings and vehicles.
Any psychological, any psychological preparation for what one could encounter as they enter a potential battlefield?
Right. So as we moved on and evolved within the phases of OIF over the years, what I do recall is that
OIF
prior
is
to
Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Yes, Iraqi Freedom. During this POR process, I do recall filling out certain mental health type questionnaires, which asked me several questions about myself and my history and my family's history. Mm-hmm. And then when I redeployed, when I was done with the unit, I had to go through the same set of questionnaires asking me questions. And of course, then I received periodic medical checkups. I will tell you that if any issues are noted at that time, and for me, fortunately, there were not, but if any issues were noted at that time, there would be follow-ups with the unit's medical staff.
Now, the suspect here, Esteban Santiago, he did find himself in trouble with the law in Alaska upon his return. He was charged with assault and criminal mischief after a fight with his girlfriend. He pleaded no contest. Those charges were due to essentially be dropped in the spring of this year if he stayed out of trouble. How are cases, these kind of scrapes with the law involving veterans, how are they usually handled in the judicial system?
Well, I can address in a very generic sense how they're handled in Hillsborough County. In Hillsborough County, we have the Veterans Treatment Court, or right. what's known as the VTC. This is actually part of a national program, and they're growing in size. There's approximately 463 such courts in over 40 states in the United States. And the way we do it here in Hillsborough County is this Veterans Treatment Court identifies defendants in the jail system to determine three things. Were they veterans? What was the nature of their discharge from the service? And then the third condition is, did the criminal act that they committed, was there somehow a service connection to a disability or a disorder that they suffered or was incurred upon them in military service?
Let me take those through by qualifying as a veteran for this special Veterans Treatment Court. Is that a current veteran of the what's considered what Gulf War II era veterans?
The general rule is a veteran is any man or woman who has served a military uniform in any of the U.S. military services.
Okay, and then
so the way to prove that, the easiest way to prove that is by submitting your form DD Form 214, which actually shows your service. Mm-hmm. The military branch, and then the time you served, and then your discharge.
Second qualifying factor for this Veterans Treatment Court in Hillsborough County, the nature of the discharge. The suspect in this case, Esteban Santiago, reportedly received a general discharge, not a dishonorable, not an honorable, but a general.
Yes. And so for purposes of qualification for the Veterans Treatment Court, they will accept veterans that have honorable discharges or general discharges under honorable conditions, but not dishonorable discharges.
And then the crime committed here by a veteran, the third qualifying factor for the special treatment court, is a criminal act connected to some kind of service issue. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is among the most common, perhaps. Does that have to be documented in some medical fashion prior to the beginning of an accused veteran to be involved in this court system?
Okay, so based on my experience working in the VTC, there's two situations that I've experienced. One, there is when we interview the defendant and we look through his records or her records, we do find written records or diagnoses from the past while in military service indicating some sort of mental illness or disorder or disability. The second one is we don't have that proof. And so when these defendants come to court before the judge, with the assistance of the state attorney, the public defender, and the Veterans Administration representative known as the VJO, they huddle and then they determine that this defendant may be qualified, but we need to do a diagnosis on him. And so the judge will then order a VA diagnosis from one of the mental health providers, one of the doctors, to determine whether or not it is a case of post-traumatic stress, perhaps traumatic brain injury, substance abuse, et cetera, et cetera.
And Colonel Reyes, how does this Veterans Court program differ from a standard judicial encounter that another accused criminal may have?
Well, I'll tell you, if you go to a Veterans Treatment Court, and I invite you and those in our listening audience to please look up on www.justiceforvets.org, where you can find the nearest VTC in your area, you should observe it, because on the onset, it does look like a regular criminal court. You have the judge, you have the state attorney or district attorney, and you have the public defender. But then that's where the similarities end, because the whole purpose of this court is not punishment, it's rehabilitation and treatment. The state and the defense and the judge and the VA and all local VA providers that provide support to the veteran are in that court with one sole purpose: to help identify any underlying disabilities or disorders, to help treat and rehabilitate that veteran, and then to reintegrate them successfully back into the community as a law-abiding and contributing citizen.
Colonel,
that's where it's different from a regular criminal court.
Colonel Reyes, stick with us here. We want to talk about that reintroduction back into civilian society, including transitioning from military service to civilian employment. That will continue as the Sunshine Economy continues after this. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. The last known job of the alleged Fort Lauderdale airport attacker was as a security guard in Alaska. DJ Reyes is a retired U.S. Army colonel. He served as a top intelligence officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, now works as a mentor for veterans in the Tampa Bay area. He joins us still from our Tampa sister station, WUSF. Colonel Reyes, describe the employment environment, generally speaking, for veterans in the state of Florida. What do they encounter when they transition from military service into civilian employment?
Well, one of the other roles that I play here in Hillsborough County is that of veteran employment coordinator. Separate from the Veterans Treatment Court, but it actually complements it. I will tell you, generally speaking, that veterans have not exactly the easiest time in transitioning from military to civilian. There's several reasons for that. One of them is in transitioning and in translating their job skills from what they did in the military into the civilian world. And so in my current role as an employment coordinator, I work personally with veterans, active duty as well as Guard and Reserve, and I work hand-in-hand with many of the employers in Hillsborough County and in other surrounding counties in trying to bridge that gap for them. And because of that, I believe a lot of it has to just do with education and awareness.
Just describe that gap, Colonel. Military leadership, discipline, those are positive qualities, certainly, that employers would be interested in given the relatively low unemployment rate here in the state of Florida.
Well, absolutely. But it's sometimes it's very difficult to translate what in this case, an Army platoon leader has done in commanding 40 men in combat in Iraq and the leadership qualities required to do that under stressful conditions and to translate that into a low-level or entry-level managerial position in a company, per se.
Mm-hmm. And these cases of veterans finding themselves in scrapes with the law, those that are able to go through a veterans treatment court, as you described earlier, how do those cases impact the employment situation that they find on the other end?
Now, that's another great question. Let me answer it by saying this.
And I'll say I wish I had more time, Colonel, but yes. we're tight on time here.
Sure, exactly. The good news is that we do have some local employers that are willing to work with us, but I will tell you that's more the exception rather than the rule. So we need to keep pushing this through education and through awareness so that folks know that it's worth in the community to work with employees, veterans especially that have scraped with the law, to give them a second chance.
And what do you find in terms of Florida industries, which are dominated by generally low-wage industries, especially in hospitality and tourism?
I don't quite follow your question. Can you say that again, please?
What kind of environment do you find for those veterans, especially in regards to the big industries that we have here in Florida as they're directed toward tourism?
Right. The veterans have a variety of skills, anywhere from security to IT to HR to admin to manual labor and construction. So there's a whole variety, and Florida offers a variety of types of jobs of which we believe that the veterans are well suited to. It's just connecting the veterans with those employers and those opportunities.
Colonel DJ Reyes, retired from the U.S. Army, with us from Tampa. Colonel Reyes, thank you for your time, and thank you for your service to this country as well.
Well, thank you for having me again.
That is the Sunshine Economy here today. Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.